Okay, now we can be official. Good morning, everyone. Roll call.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Yvette Etu.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please join us for the pledge.
The United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And first up, if could have a motion to approve the minutes from April 23rd.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Financial report. Morning.
Good morning. Commissioners, I'm proud to present to you the financial results of the first 4 months of the year. Looking at Cleveland Metro Parks as a whole, we've talked about property taxes before, so those are tracking as we've determined before that we've seen an improvement over the prior year. But I wanted to highlight charges for services this month. For the month, our charges for services are $400,000. Thanks, Dave. Our $400,000 up from the prior year. And as we'll see when we get to the golf and enterprise slides, weather makes a huge difference. So we'll see some more detail there. But both for the month and year to date, our charges for services are up a great amount over the prior year. On the operating expense side, our operating expenses are up about 3.5%. And that tracks right along with what we expected with our cost of living adjustments and in terms of our sales, our salaries and wages, as well as just the general rate of inflation. So that's tracking right where we expected it to be, resulting in our operating surplus being up $5.3 million or 17.8% from the prior year. And on the construction expense side, we've talked a lot about the projects that are going on right now. So there are no surprises there. The top six projects represent about $29 million of the $33 million we've spent year to date. And those projects are the Primate Forest, the Sailing Center, the Garfield Culvert Replacement, Valley Parkway, Cedar Point Bridge, and the Seneca renovation. So looking at the zoo's attendance for the first 4 months was at roughly 139,000 guests, which is up 14.4% over the prior year, which is excellent considering we had some weather challenges in those early months of this period. I had a chance to talk to Sam Cario, our director of special events and experiences, about the shortfall in rentals and events. And he explained to me and actually shared an article about this, that there's a trend in the wedding industry right now away from ballrooms and barns or these specialized event venues towards smaller venues such as restaurants and greenhouses and historic homes. So this is just a trend in the industry. And the article that he shared with me basically indicates these venues, while they're trendy right now, they really aren't set up to handle large catered events. So they believe it's a short-term trend and they'll go back to the venues that are really equipped to handle events such as that. On an operating surplus basis now, that additional revenue in general from admissions is dropping to the bottom line. We're up about $500,000 on operating surplus year over year. And then the construction expenses, it's all about Primate Forest for the zoo at present. So looking at golf, my understanding is that the month of April was the second warmest April in recorded history.
Wettest.
I'm sorry?
Wettest.
It also was the second hottest, I believe. I was surprised to hear that statistic, but it was the second warmest, I believe so. It was absolutely wet. The key with golf is not only though to have warm weather, but to have dry weather and to have the dry days be on those weekend days. And April delivered this year. And as a result, there were 36,481 rounds of golf played on Metro Parks courses in the month of April, which is a modern day record for Metro Parks golf. And year to date, rounds are up 21%, especially despite having some bad weather in those early months and a lot of rain. What I think is notable here is if you look at the revenue by category, both for the month and year to date, revenue is up for golf in every category. And I think what this shows is all the investments that golf is making, the decisions they're making about technology, about equipment, the types of board actions that have been before you for purchases of new fleets of golf carts or the technology for those carts is making the Metro Parks golf experience the best value around. Operating expenses, as you see, the team is managing through this period of great inflation, especially in the costs of managing golf courses. And roughly half of that additional revenue is falling to the bottom line, which is, I think, a testament to the golf team's ability to manage through this period of time. The capital equipment in prior months was a new fleet of golf carts at Ironwood, and for this month, it was just a few new mowers at Seneca and Ironwood. I tried a new presentation this month to make it a little bit easier, hopefully, to see the month or the year over year comparisons in operating revenue, expense, and their operating result. And the four largest stories for this period of time year to date were Big Met, Manikiki, Seneca, and Washington. And you can see substantial revenue increases for Big Met, Manikiki, and Seneca especially. And those drop to the operating result line.
Brian, do you think our share of golfing in Cleveland, the Metro Park share, is going up or down? It's probably going up, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at across kind of like the region, Northeast Ohio, courses and other, you know, communities such as Stark, Summit, Geauga have closed. And so I think the right sizing, if you look at Acacia closed, Astorhurst closed, Hawthorne Valley closed, Oakwood closed. So four other private clubs in the area closed, three of which the Metro Parks owns now. I think the market share has been rebalanced. And obviously COVID had a very, very solid influence on overall golf numbers for the last, 3, 4, 5 years, plus the investment.
Thanks.
Looking at the enterprise division, most of the enterprise locations continue to be closed during this period of time. But even so, in all three revenue categories, it was up year over year, both on a month and a year to date basis. And when we see the next slide, you can see where some of these increases lie. And on operating expense standpoint, really, because we're on a cash basis for this reporting, what you're seeing is the ramp up of these locations to get ready for the busy season. So we're expending funds now to bring those locations back online. And a couple of those locations were closed in the prior year, so there was even more ramp up to be done to get them ready for the season. But even so, on an operating surplus basis, we're ahead of the prior year for both a month and a year to date basis. And the roughly $90,000 of construction expenses you see, those are interior renovations at Merwin's Wharf. And again, with a similar presentation to golf, trying to represent all of the enterprise locations on a revenue, expense, and operating result basis. North Coast Harbor, new this year. But I think it's noteworthy that we've already received about $76,000 worth of transient dock rentals at North Coast Harbor, even though the season really hasn't started yet. And Hinkey Lake Boathouse is new to the enterprise presentation this year and was also closed for rentals and other last year. But you're seeing $20,000 dropping to the year over year increase. And I failed to highlight parking, but that's another great story. Parking revenue is $97,000 for this 4 months, and that's a $25,000 or a 35% increase over the prior year.
Where do you have the marina at by Wendy Park and the 55th Street concession? That's in a separate.
Correct. So what we did is I put East 55th and the Sailing Center on the same line because it was formerly the East 55th restaurant. It's in the same location, but it's a new venue. So I put those on the same line from a comparative standpoint. But obviously the 55th restaurant was demolished in January of last year, so it didn't really exist for the season last year.
And then you don't have the revenues from the Wendy Park concession there, the restaurant concession, and the other stuff.
So look, the Whiskey Island concession and that, right, correct. Those don't fall under enterprise.
Okay.
We have a separate concessionaire division where we track those, where we have third-party arrangements for the facilities operated by third parties.
Okay.
So that concludes the financial presentation. I'm willing to answer any other questions that you have.
No, I think we're good. Ryan?
Very good. 2026 budget adjustment number four, Gary.
So commissioners, budget adjustment number four actually represents a decrease in appropriations of about $3.2 million. And the reason for that is last month, our budget adjustment included a $10 million additional appropriation for a commitment letter from the Zoo Society funding the primate forest. And what we did is we went back and we recalculated the numbers to make sure that we didn't require capital funds for those monies that they had contributed. At the beginning of the year, the original appropriations included the full amount budgeted for the primate forest that we funds we needed to get to the completion of sequence one. So we did not have the commitment from the Zoo Society at that point. So it was budgeted in capital funds. So we appropriated now the Zoo Society's money, and this is removing the $10 million from the capital budget for the primate forest. And it does, we've confirmed with planning and design that that still leaves us with the correct amount of budget to finish the project. And then that's offset by a $5 million appropriation of a new grant for Irish Town Bend. So it nets, it all nets to about a $3 million reduction in overall appropriations.
Thank you. Motion?
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is establish the date of the hearing for the 2027 proposed tax budget in accordance with what we do as a separate political subdivision of the state of Ohio. We have set the proposed tax budget meeting here June 10th, 2026 at 10 a.m. Gary Busbeck will oversee it and it will be in this office. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 10.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next is the authorization of the building infrastructure buyback payment for North Coast Harbor Marina. This is something that became part of the Cleveland Metro Parks through the 7th Amendment through the lease for the lakefront properties between the City of Cleveland and Cleveland Metro Parks. 6.22 acres came into the Metro Parks under the rebuild from one of the storms. North Coast Harbor was awarded boating infrastructure grant, which is known as the BIG, awarded by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. What it does is it gives it only certain parameters that allow them to be transient in nature only. And what we're trying to do is create an ecosystem down there where we can bring people in and out. And so the transient nature does not allow for that. So we, the Metro Parks, are doing a dock buyback for the uses of more stable revenue throughout, and you can see the revenue that is coming in against it. And the recommended action falls based on a calculation that we worked with ODNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, in the amount of $167,401.50 to do the dock buyback program that allows the Cleveland Metro Parks the flexibility to lease the docks not in the transient mode. Recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 11.
I apologize. Can you define transient and what we're doing?
Yeah, so the 15, we can get a year-long season contract with a boating company, okay. Year-long, and transient is for a period of specific days. That's just the
nature. So what do we do with those year-long leases?
We have them all rented already.
To whom?
All different types of businesses that will operate out of there, the brew boat, fishing, and a number of others.
So you can budget it better. Nice.
But also private citizens, right?
They could be, but right now they're the way they're taken up is in that fashion.
Okay, move the motion. Mm-hmm.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next, Rocky River Emerald Necklace Marine Kayak, Marina Kayak Launch Drop-Off. This is change order number two. This is a contract with RJ Joseph Construction. As we were doing some of the work, we realized that we had a section of bulkhead cap that had failed more than likely through the rough winter that we had, 64 linear feet of failing bulkhead capping. We got a cost not to exceed $60,000. It's basically welding a plate on top, backfilling aggregate, and repaving the riverfront access. So we're taking care of this. The original revised amount falls in the mid portion of page 12.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Change order number one, contract 1853, Mill Creek Bank Stabilization. This is in Garfield Park Reservation. This is part of a larger project that we got funded through the Great Lakes Commission, Ohio Department of Natural Resources, H2 Ohio. River Reach was awarded the project. We had some other work, about 115 feet of noticed erosion. Seems to be a consistent theme. We are a riparian type of system, so we do have a few of these unique areas that do happen, escarpments over time. We completed work to complete the work here in the summer of 2026, but it's stabilizing a portion of bank in the Mill Creek in Garfield Park Reservation, the amount of 25 grand. Recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 13.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, Brian. This next item is with respect to appointing Brian in his official capacity to the North Coast Waterfront New Community Authority Board. I think we've all seen in the media and know that the city of Cleveland is working to develop the lakefront. And in that spirit, two entities have been created, the North Coast Waterfront Development Corporation and also the North Coast Waterfront New Community Authority. Brian has been appointed to serve on the authority, which is the quasi-governmental arm, which will be the financing entity. It makes sense for him to serve on this board, but because under Ohio ethics laws, there may be the potential for us to work closely as Cleveland Metro Parks with this authority, it's best practice to appoint him in his official capacity as CEO of the Metro Parks to serve on that board. And that's what this resolution would authorize, his appointment, and that recommended action is on the top of page 14.
Just a question, you said he was appointed?
It is, yes, yes. He was, he is nominated to be appointed, and then this would be your allowing him, yeah.
Can you explain a little more about what those, what the duties are of both of those groups?
So the one that I can speak to is as Rose mentioned, as businesses opt in or businesses are created, they can opt into, for instance, a great example would be Huntington Bank Field and parking. So they could ask for a $5 commitment per ticket that would go into this new community development authority, of which then they would bond against once they have some revenues. And then they would work on putting infrastructure into the portion north of the stadium currently. The current stadium, it looks to be there through 26, 27, 28, and 29 seasons, plus or minus. And then after that, they'll be looking at a total redevelopment of that site that's called the North Coast Harbor.
Okay.
So the authority's the money. Who does the planning?
So it's a little of both. I think there's a steering committee, and what I can speak to is folks like Greg Harris, Kirsten Ellenbogen, folks from the city, Haslam Sports Groups, and Scott and others are part of kind of the overarching, and then the funding is controlled by individuals that are appointed by city council and other folks. So that would be mine.
Thank you. Motion?
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the tabulation of award and bids.
I thought we had a minute. Sorry.
We'll continue. Tabulation of award bids. There happens to be four of them. Solid waste, cybersecurity, amendment for technology and web service, and a utility bucket truck. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 15.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Now you can do vouchers and payroll.
Resolution 2605-062, It's $15,486,709 of vouchers that have been reviewed as to their legality and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And then Resolution 26-05-063. These are vouchers that have been reviewed as to their legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code that relate to Arborware in the amount of $230.
Move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
We'll note Commissioner Moore's abstention.
All right. Public comments. Oh, okay.
I just wanted to come in so that the Metro Parks will formally acknowledge the contributions that Lenny Stover made over the course of his life. He passed recently on April 22nd, the night before he was working on Snake Hill. And, you know, the Metro Parks has given people connections to so many assets in Northeast Ohio. The whole west side now has access to the Cuyahoga River, thanks to the Red Line Greenway. And that Tiger Grant was the first grant, am I not mistaken, that the Metro Parks ever received because of all of the voluntary contributions of Rotary and led by Lenny. And it took the Metro Parks and the towpath all the way to the lake. And to borrow Brian's expression, GSD, you know, he's the master of getting shit done. He was the master of getting shit done. And whether the Metro Parks knows it or not, the Cuyahoga Valley now will connect Hudson because Lenny was working on that trail. He was helping Hudson connect to the bike and hike trail, which takes you all the way to Bedford, basically. And more significantly, Brandywine and Peninsula. So the tourism opportunities are amazing, especially with e-bikes. And you, whether you're aware of it or not, he was working on Snake Hill in this neighborhood. And for people who live here, it's meant a lot because they've always wanted a trail connection to the zoo. And in the future, that trail connection can connect to Brighton. And if you haven't been to Calgary Park, you should see Calgary Park because it's basically a metro park. It's a City of Cleveland park, but it can connect on the north side of the lower Big Creek Valley all the way to the towpath. So all those connections, Snake Hill to Brighton to Calgary to the towpath, were made possible. And just as a final note, his family asked that donations be contributed to the trail fund, to the Cleveland Metro Parks. And so I hope there's some way you can honor him by not dismissing the idea of the Red Line Greenway going all the way across the river, connecting the east side and the west side, and the trail network that City of Cleveland has their all-purpose trails. They're not managed well. But they will connect. I mean, you can walk from downtown Cleveland, where you have that beautiful signage, all the way to Tremont along the trails that the city has there. And then your East Side network are going to connect at East 34th to all of the, you know, bits and pieces that have been identified over the years. And I don't want you to discount the fact that the bridge over the viaduct is can change with alignments that are going to happen with the new cars. And on the east side, people have always been crossing those tracks anyways on the blue and green lines, and now all of that will change. So that's it. Please honor Lenny's.
Thank you very much.
I think everyone here has a profound respect for volunteers like Stover. I mean, they're what make this thing work, and it's the passion we get from them that drives us forward. So I think we're all appreciate all the work he's done enormously, but we're also mindful of the challenges of trying to go across the top of a railroad bridge.
Just think big.
Yeah.
No little plans.
I'm not a big fan of ever following you. on social media of how the city of Cleveland or how Cuyahoga County is operating. So, but I still hold out hope and I'm grateful. I also serve on a Metro Health Committee and I'm grateful for the support that Metro Parks gives to Metro Health, but go a little bigger.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marty?
I absolutely agree with the credit due to Lenny. I mean, he was a visionary and didn't just talk. A few points, short if not simple, but I hope for real responses. How did you address the Hinckley community concerns about alcohol and rescue equipment at the lake? Promoting things, booze, cigars, lottery, that are actually injurious does not justify revenue. Installing AstroTurf now that risks are known. So these happen elsewhere. All the more reason to avoid it here. Take the high road. Flock cameras, which I had supported, now are becoming a behemoth. Who are you allowing access to your info? How are you monitoring that? Your very ambitious building plans will require a huge amount of maintenance. Where is the money being set aside? Even without the risk of losing property tax income, what and where are the plans? What was the real reason, given the already long lead time, that the budget was not ready and posted in March? That does not demonstrate budget book, I guess I should say. That does not demonstrate orderly preparation, especially with all the technology and personnel you have. We are witnessing an unprecedented, sick, destruction of environmental, health, safety, and financial safeguards now. Some have long-term consequences, but many are imminent threats. Do your part by protecting the public and showing plans for worst-case outcomes. A walk in the woods is restorative, but can't overcome everything. Thank you for your attention to these matters.
Thank you.
Rose, can I ask a question? Who can get the license plate information that people are squabbling about now? Do we have requests frequently or?
Right. So I think, Commissioner, why don't we, to delve into those issues, we can meet with Chief Stillman to talk about it and, you know, get into the more specifics. But I don't want to get into the police operations as a matter of the, you know, in the public sector.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll talk offline. And then if it merits an information item where we can do a presentation that the police have gone through and vetted what information is good to share publicly, I think that might be a good forum and way to go about sharing
Excellent.
Information. Okay. Great. Thanks.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Anthony Beard. I'm here representing the United Residents of Euclid Beach. And everyone here is here because of their affinity towards the parks. And everyone here and everyone who part of my organization understands that parks matter. Green space matters. But also the legacy and memory of people matter also. People live at Euclid Beach of all different stripes. Many experienced during this process where the park moved from a living space to eventually being given to the Metro Parks, experienced a lot of hardship, a lot of stress, and emotional uncertainty. And so I ask that the Metro Parks place a permanent historical marker or memorial plaque, some marker to honor the individuals who lived at the Euclid Beach site. This statement is not a political statement. It's not an accusation. It's not an attack. It's just a acknowledgement, and it's a truthful ask to honor the memory and the recognition that people actually live there as the park begins to transform and the green space, the grass, the trees, and the animals walk across the same area. Communities across the country often routinely preserve the memory of what came before. So I don't believe the ask is all that far-fetched. And I want to also recognize that I understand that there may have been some disagreements along the way of this process, being a 3-4 year process to get us to the point we are now. And often advocacy on the part of the members of the United Residents of Euclid Beach often creates tension in the community. But ultimately, it came together. And we're not trying to relitigate the past. We're just asking for dignity and a historical acknowledgement. And so, even as the land changes, there still memory remains. And so on behalf of Tony, Charlotte, Beverly, Linda, Debbie, Gwendolyn, John, Steve, and Lenny, all of whom perished before this process was complete, I ask you again to place a permanent marker acknowledging the residents of Euclid Beach at Euclid Beach Park. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else? All right, thank you. Moving right along. Ryan.
First information briefing item is first reading of cybersecurity policy. Things have changed dramatically. Rose?
Yes, thank you, Brian. Commissioners, I first want to start off by mentioning that the annual audit that was just completed did show full compliance with our Ohio Public Records Act. While the state auditor has discontinued his STARS program, which since its inception, we scored the highest 5 stars every year. He discontinued that formal program, but the annual audit still requires a compliance review of our public records program. And again, full compliance. So that's always great to see for an objective third party to have that. On that note, in the context of public records, we also have to deal with the realities and challenges that we're faced with. As far as being a public entity whose most of our records are accessible by the public, we are in the age of cyber attacks and sophisticated cyber attacks. For several years, and formally since 2017, we've had a cybersecurity program that has largely been driven by a collaboration between legal and IT. We've had a CEO level policy that guided our actions. We've had a change in Ohio law in response to these attacks that are happening, leveraging publicly accessible information. And so our Ohio law has changed. And so we're coming before you today with this information item. And Priscilla Rocha and Phil are going to give you a presentation. So if you guys want to come up, they're primarily going to talk about, the basis and foundation and the impetus for the necessity to bring the cybersecurity policy to the board level, which Ohio law requires. So they're going to fill in a lot of what is happening in this space. And then they're not going to painstakingly go through every section of the policy, which is highly technical. I can meet with you individually offline to go into the nitty gritty of it if you have questions. But we thought this was a foundational sort of discussion to launch us into the basis of the policy and understand the why, and then answer any policy specific questions that you have. This is the first reading, so of course we'll be back to you again next month to field additional questions that you may have as well. Thank you, Priscilla and Phil.
Thank you, Rose, and good morning, commissioners. By way of introduction, my name is Priscilla Rocha. I am, amongst other things, the Park District's data privacy and cybersecurity attorney. And I'm joined today by Phil Brizico, our cybersecurity architect. And today we're going to go over changes in Ohio law that apply to local government entities. And the law is was HB 96 until it passed. It was in the budget bill. This is not moving. No. And we'll go through a high level overview of the law. But before we get there, I always like to start with the cyber threat and to give you some context as to why the law is important. So this slide here illustrates what we're dealing with state and local governments. I pulled this data from the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. That report is very robust. It applies to both the private sector and the public sector. And what they do, what Verizon does every year, is they go through about 22,000 investigations of cyber incidents and data breaches that we know about. And then they provide all of this data on how those breaches and incidents occurred. And the cybersecurity industry uses that to help kind of get a good framework of what the landscape looks like. So if you look at this graph on the left, the top bar, that's state and local governments, and the bottom bar is federal government. And you can see that the breaches are much higher in the state and local government category versus the federal. And you might be wondering why is that? Part of it is that state and local governments, we have a treasure trove of valuable information that attackers want. We have a lot of data, personal data about individuals, our constituents. We also have a lot of trade secret information about companies that work with us. We have our own trade secrets. So there's a whole host of information that attackers want that state and local governments have that the federal government might not have as much of. In addition, local governments can be under-resourced. So there are times where some government agencies have no cybersecurity staff or have very limited cybersecurity staff. And attackers know that, and they try to use that to take advantage of the agency. In addition to all of that, we also manage and maintain critical infrastructure like bridges, dams, roads, all the trails, a zoo. So we have a lot of infrastructure that, if attacked, can cause a lot of high potential for damage and disruption. In addition, we can't forget about the human element across the board in the public sector and private sector. Around 60% of the breaches that we see in the United States are as a result of human behavior. So humans clicking on a phishing link or smishing or deepfakes. So this is still a very big problem in the industry, and every organization faces it. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Phil to talk about some of the threats that we see. Okay, you started.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
So yes, cybersecurity has increased dramatically here in the last few years. I have some cases here that will kind of give an overview of the certain types of attack related to personal records. So we have case one, open record contract weaponization. So these fraud syndicates utilized vendor contracts and directories to deviate funds from these particular, the county and the city of the examples in the slide, 3.2 million. From recollection, it should be 2.5 from the North Carolina and about 750,000 from Florida. And the way they were able to do this is with all of the information public from their records, and they're able to create a particular workflow to compromise the financial funds payment and deviated those payments over to those threat actors. Vulnerability, public compliance records, always provided a pre-built social engineering blueprint, bypassing technical controls. Case two, we're all very familiar with. MGM is the casino. Caesar's Palace and MGM were compromised in 2023 due to the threat actor ransomware group called Scattered Spider. And that is just one of its names. That threat actor group has multiple names, and they just change it depending on how they want to approach or attack environments. So this one was where the Scattered Spider Group did some intel on the MGM Resort's IT staff. And from that, they were able to find the particular help desk individuals. So when they did make contact via vishing, which is a voice type of attack, they had a 10-minute conversation and basically guided that individual or help desk employee to hand over credentials, which resulted in a $100 million loss. The vulnerability, attackers use easily accessible personal information to bypass standard help desk security questions, and which led to the compromise of MGM. Case three is more of a focus on AI. Again, over the last couple of years, AI has dramatically increased from a threat actor standpoint. So fraud syndicates utilize AI-driven workflows, programs, and what they do is they develop these workflows to start scraping Ohio agencies. And from that, they can get a handful of information on the fly. And then they can utilize that information to then fish the organization via whaling, which is a executive level type of attack, or spear phishing related to MGM, where it's targeting the help desk or it's targeting the finance and utilizing certain contracts and some of that granularized information to then potentially compromise the environment. So one of the ways we can mitigate is through sanitizing, making sure public records don't have some of that granularized information. So threat actors can't create a particular attack path. And these are some of the examples of what type of information's out there that threat actors use. Organizational charts, staff directories, public procurement, technology disclosures, meeting agendas, calendars, reports, personal records, license. The takeaway is that every public disclosure from contracts to calendars can be weaponized. Agencies must treat public records as a part of their attack service, carefully redacting sensitive details and balancing transparency with security.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, so what do we do about that that threat that we that all these local governments are facing? What the Ohio General Assembly has done is it has enacted this new law, which is codified in Revised Code Section 9.64. Under the new law, which is now effective, all government agencies in the state have to implement a cybersecurity program. As Rose mentioned, we've had a program in place since 2017. We are making some updates to that, which is why the policy is before you for a first reading. We also have to obtain your approval to move forward with our program and our policy. And then there's a new framework for reporting cyber incidents, which we'll speak to a little bit later. All agencies have to develop this program. The program has to be established based on keeping the data and systems secure, ensuring confidentiality, integrity, and availability of those data and systems. And the programs also have to follow best practices like the NIST cybersecurity framework or the CIS security controls. A little background on NIST. So what is NIST? How did it come to be? So in 2013, President Obama implemented an executive order to establish NIST. NIST is a sub-agency of the United States Department of Commerce. It is not a oversight agency. It's an agency that basically develops frameworks to keep organizations across the United States secure in a cybersecurity context. And so they developed this framework, the NIST framework. We were previously on the CIS controls framework. We've now moved over to NIST, which you'll see in the policy. And NIST is a flexible, scalable framework that helps any organization from like a global company like Parker Hannifin, for example, also uses NIST, to a local government agency like Cleveland Metro Parks, identify our gaps, and then prioritize a plan to close those gaps. There are six core functions to NIST. I'm not going to go through all of them, but the policy does identify them. So if you have any questions about that, please reach out to Rose or me and happy to assist you with answering those questions. But what's so great about NIST is that it works the same way, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a government agency of our size and scope. So you're able to tailor the framework to the assets that you have. And back to HB 96. So who does it apply to? It applies to all cities and counties. It was effective for cities and counties as of January 1st, 2026. It is now effective, or will be effective, excuse me, for all other government agencies like political subdivisions as of July 1st, 2026. That's why we're bringing these policies to you now. For the first reading, the incident reporting requirements are already effective. So if there is an incident or breach that occurs, we will be reporting those as required by the law. And in addition, we will now be audited on our compliance with this law. So starting fiscal year 2026, the Ohio Auditor of State will audit us based on our program's compliance with 9.64. With respect to ransomware payments, we hope to never be the victim of a ransomware attack, but if we ever are, we will have to determine whether we're going to pay that ransom or not. Hopefully we don't. Part of the reason this law was enacted was to discourage government agencies to pay, use taxpayer funds to pay ransoms. So in the event that we are attacked and there is a ransomware situation, again, hope there never is, we would come to you for approval to pay a ransomware. And also we would need to justify why paying that ransom was in the best interest of the jurisdiction. Hopefully that never happens. And in addition, the new law imposes some new notification obligations. So now if we are the victim of an incident or ransomware, cyber incident or breach, we now have to report that to the Ohio Department of Public Safety within 7 days. So strict and tight turnaround time there. And we also have to report that to the Ohio Auditor of State within 30 days. That is in our policy as well. And in addition to the program requirements, there's now a new public records exemption that Phil was alluding to in this new law. So records related to the cybersecurity program itself, cyber incident reports, and cyber-related procurement documents are now exempt under the Ohio Sunshine Law. This will help us protect the confidentiality of our sensitive systems while also balancing our duties under Sunshine Laws. What is a public record? Just a little refresher. We all know that public records are any records, regardless of where they're stored, that document the functions of the organization unless they are excluded by law. And this law gives us a couple more exemptions, some existing exemptions. So we've always had the infrastructure record exemption, and that exemption exempts records that apply to critical systems that a government agency has. So your plumbing systems, your electrical systems, security systems, et cetera, but it also covers computer systems and security codes. In addition, we've also had in place the security records exemption. That exemption covers records that an organization uses to keep itself safe from sabotage, from terrorism, from all sorts of different things that ways that organizations can be attacked. So those two exemptions have been in place for a while, but now with the new law, we have a new exemption for cybersecurity records codified in 9.64. There are two prongs to this exemption. The first prong is any records or reports related to the program itself. They are not going to be public records. And then also reports of any cybersecurity incidents or any breaches or ransomware incidents are also not going to be public records. And you can see why that would be important. We don't want to give people a roadmap on how to attack us in the future. And then the second prong of the exemption relates to procurement documents. So any record identifying a cybersecurity related software program, hardware, goods or services that is being considered for procurement, has been procured or is being used by a political subdivision, including things like the vendor name, the product name, the project name, and project description, are now going to be exempt as well. And this prong of the law is broad by design. What the Ohio General Assembly was trying to achieve is allowing government agencies to determine what they need to keep safe to keep their organization safe or keep redacted or sanitized to keep their organization safe. So a couple of things that we've identified right off the bat are the model numbers and descriptions of our computer equipment. If a hacker or threat actor knows that we are using this type of operating system or this type of equipment, they can easily go on the internet, find a vulnerability, and determine whether we might have an unpatched area of our system that they can then attack. So it's really important that we are not releasing this information. I was actually at a conference speaking to some CISOs at some private corporations, and they were actually shocked to learn that government agencies were ever even releasing this information to begin with, because they would never, because it's such an easy way to hack your company if you know the type of equipment that everyone is running on their desks. So that information will now be not released. Employee ID numbers and employee titles on HR lists. So the way that threat actors use this is they'll look at my title and say, okay, she's a cybersecurity lawyer. She's going to be out of town in Hawaii. I hope I go to Hawaii someday. Hawaii for a week. We have our meeting calendar. We know she's going to be gone. We have her employee ID number. We can just pretend that we're her and spoof her email. And that's how they get in. And then the whole system is attacked. So that's why we keep these types of things, it's important to keep these types of things confidential. Cybersecurity vendor names and services. So, you know, we use forensics vendors. We have other vendors that we use that help us keep our systems secure and our network secure. If a threat actor is able to identify who we're using, it's very easy for them to know the type of penetration testing we're doing, the type of vulnerability assessments we're doing. So it's really important that we keep that information secure. And you saw that we brought that to the board today in a more secure manner, so that vendor is not identified in the public record. And then our cyber insurance documents. So if a vendor or a threat actor knows what our policy limits are, what our cyber insurance looks like, they can use that to craft a ransom demand and essentially extort us. So we don't want to, you know, release that information. It puts us at a disadvantage and opens us up to attack. And so that brings us to our cybersecurity update. It's here before you for a first reading. There'll be a second reading in June. You'll notice that we've added information indicating that our policy is NIST aligned, and it also aligns with the requirements of Section 9.64 of the Ohio Revised Code. In addition, it goes through a lot of details that we need our workforce to adhere to: password protection, you know, keeping their badges secure, et cetera. So physical protections, also digital protections. So you'll see all of that in the policy. So if you do have any questions, please reach out to Rose or I. We're happy to address them before the second reading in June. And with that, I will say go Cavs, and I'll open the floor up to questions.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who funds the mandate?
Who funds the mandate under the law?
Mm-hmm. Who pays for this?
We pay for this. So yes, we pay for this. It is on the government agencies across Ohio to fund the resources to keep their systems.
So the same government that's been restricting local government funding is also requiring they spend more money.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
So Ohio.
So yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's very helpful.
The next information item we have is Outdoor Experiences Division Highlights. Beth?
Thank you to the board for letting me gush about some really exciting new programming and outdoor experiences. Thank you, Brian, for letting me present today. So, all right, big button is forward.
Yep.
Got it. All right, so in November of 2024, there were changes to the Outdoor Experiences Department, and we created something called Community Programs. Now, the mission of this department was to connect urban audiences to the green spaces in and around Cleveland. And it was comprised of two units that we already had: mobile outreach and youth outdoors. Both of these departments are going to continue to keep doing the same really great work that they're already doing in the communities. So you may know mobile outreach does the very fun kids nature lunch and learn in the summer, take the big RV out to three different reservations every week all summer, partner with the Greater Cleveland Food Bank, everyone gets lunch, get a cool experience with an animal, maybe play a game about migration, all of those different things.
here's some cool pictures to look at about it. Tuesday nights in the newly renovated Garfield Park Reservation are urban line dancing events. Those will pull like 200 or 300 people a night. They're singing, they're dancing, they're having a great time in the summer. Now that's our mobile outreach department. Now Youth Outdoors on the right-hand side there, that's a picture from our fishing derbies that just happened last weekend. 2 days of kids fishing derbies. We saw 1,000 guests. So this was like first time kid fishermen, and like hooks were going everywhere, little tiny kids catching really big fish. It was chaos in the best way. This also houses one of my favorite programs, the Youth Outdoors Fellowship Program. So this is for youth 14 to 18. We give them like career building skills, how to make a resume, how to do a cover letter, how to speak in public. But the best part of that program is they get the opportunity to interview for jobs in Cleveland Metro Parks. So I'm excited to say that this summer, 6 of those kids will be working as seasonals in Cleveland Metro Parks in outdoor experiences and golf. Oops. So all of those things are still happening, like I said, on those two sides of my little Venn diagram there. But when the teams came together, I was trying to find an opportunity for them to work on something collectively. And I was taking a look at maybe some of the things we were missing in some of our programming. And I looked directly at Lake Erie. So I was looking at hitting education, recreation, and pulling in our natural resources department to cover conservation. We came up with this idea for a program called My Great Lake. So here's kind of the vision of this program. Every fall, we're going to put a fish, probably 3 fish, in a tank in classrooms in Euclid, East Cleveland, and Collinwood. And then throughout the year, the kids are going to use that tank as kind of a window to Lake Erie. So they're going to learn English, math, science, art, all the things that they have to, but they can tie in this fish that they're raising throughout the year. Then at some point during the year, the MO team, Mobile Outreach, and the YO team, Youth Outdoors, goes to the school with the big RV, the Traveling Nature Center, and we do like the big Miss Frizzle assembly, right? There's big science experiments, and they get to see an animal and tour the big nature tracks, and they have like this engaging, inspiring experience. Then in May, they take the fish, dump it in a bucket, get on a bus, and go to Euclid Creek. And they go to Wildwood Park, and then they get on the barge, they do science experiments, they play in the park, and then they go dump their fish in Euclid Creek and release it out into Lake Erie. I really think that will forge that connection to protection for Lake Erie, because you care about, you're going to protect what you care about, right? And we know they're going to name these fish. It's going to be like Mr. Sparklegills or something like that, and they're going to care deeply about Mr. Sparklegills. So then they will be connected to Lake Erie. As soon as that is over, we start in the beginning of June with our summer camps. So there are 7 weeks of free summer camps in Euclid Beach. And hopefully the kids come to those, they experience all of that, they bring their family, and the whole cycle starts back over again in the fall. It's a big dream. It's a lot of things going on. But how do we make it bigger? So looking at My Great Lake as an umbrella, we can then do a variety of program. It doesn't just have to be the fish. So we can go kayaking. We can do a family fishing day. Our outreach manager, Angelique Hilsman, suggested a fish fry, but I was like, not too close to the fish release day. We can't overlap those. We got to have a gap. But I think the best part, it wasn't him, kid. I think the most important part of this program is this dynamic engagement. So this allows this program to connect with natural resources and whatever's happening in Cleveland Metro Parks, in natural resources, in the community, in the world. So we can be dynamic and change this programming as we go along. I'm ready to pilot 10 schools in 2026, and hopefully, depending on donor money or however that goes, we can increase that over time. So kind of the journey of how this started. So we started with 4 free weeks of camp in Euclid Beach in 2022. There were 65 campers. We partnered with the food bank. They got breakfast, lunch. We sent them home with food. We went walked up to Nottingham Memorial Library, got them all library cards. It was a great camp. But the reception was huge. The wait lists were ginormous. So I had to figure out a way to how we can make this bigger. So we ended up applying for this Institute of Museum and Library Sciences grant. It's a federal grant. First year, we applied, hopes and dreams, they shot us down. But we got really good feedback, so we reapplied that, and then we applied again in 2024. We got awarded. We got the award. 2025 came and found out we were defunded. It was not going to happen. IMLS was temporarily shut down, crushed.
Then it was like a day or two before Thanksgiving or a day or two after Thanksgiving, I get a text from Mary Rouse that says, check your email right now. We got refunded. So we got the money back and we had everything all ready. So we just hit the ground running with the summer camp. So where we're sitting right now, we have that federal grant, $237,000 over the course of 3 years. And that's going to fund the fish tanks, the nets, the cool things to send home with the kids, a full-time staff person, and two seasonal staff. Our donations also came in through our development department, which was really worked really hard with us to try to make this work. They were able to get $330,000 to revamp the nature tracks vehicle. So that's the exhibits on the outside, and then like a cool wrap on the outside that maybe is like not virtual, augmented reality. Yeah, thank you. So it just does cool things when you look at it. We also had a donation for our fellowship program. And every time we talk to people about this, they just get excited and they want to help. So we actually called this fishery to try to get these sunfish for the program. We started talking to them about it. And they're like, stop. We're just going to give you the fish. Which, okay, it's only 120 sunfish, but it was just really sweet. And it was really nice that they were involved in the program. So outside of operating budget, we're now sitting at $667,000 in external funding to make this happen for the next 3 years. No pressure, right? So what does this mean? In 2 weeks, summer camp starts. 7 weeks of summer camp, free camp in Euclid. The kids are doing STEM activities on the beach. They're swimming, they're learning, they're having a great time. As soon as they go back to school, the fish is in their classroom and we complete the cycle every year. I really think this is going to be a great way, a new way for youth to connect to Lake Erie and Cleveland. Thank you so much.
Super.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is no old business. At the date of the next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, June 18th here in the Rozepka boardroom. There is an executive session.
Gross. Is there a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of discussing the purchase and acquisition of real property?
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Bruce Rinker.
Yes.
Yvette Itu.
Yes.
Dan Moore.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to executive session. We'll come back, but we'll have no further formal business to vote on.
Commissioner Moore.
We're back.
Just real quick for the vote.
Just need a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye, aye, aye.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Very efficient.